Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I am Floodman 11, and today we're going to be covering off the prototype classes for the 2018 24 Hours of Le Mans. And with me today, I have Cookie Monster FL. How are you going tonight, Cookie?
Doing well, Flood.
That's awesome to hear. And also with us, we've got our resident aerodynamic expert, Trevor Vasaurus. How are you going?
All right, cheers.
That's your official moniker now. You can't escape it.
Oh, no.
You sound so disappointed.
All that pressure. Hey-o!
So, we're going to be talking about the prototype classes for Le Mans this year. So, if you're listening to us live, you should have Andy Blackmore's Spotter's Guide up. If not, you should have that up anyway, because it's beautiful. But first, before we get into that, Cookie, the brief, kind of vague-ish sort of outline for the future 2020-2021 regulations for the prototype, quote-unquote prototype class, has been released-ish, I guess, and you wanted to talk about it.
Well, slightly. I assume we're going to be getting a actual kind of framework, and just as a quick guideline or timeline almost, is that we probably won't get the official regs in terms of, like, here's the FIA briefing bulletin with a packet full of paper outlining very, very technical details of everything in P1, probably until, I would say, August or September. But what Le Mans would be is just a framework, a groundwork, going, hey, look, it's probably going to be like this. We're going to get all the details ironed out, but this is the direction we're looking at. So
what is the direction that they're looking at?
So from what the technical director, Jill Simon, is saying in the latest Autosport article that was released, or the FIA article, was that he's looking at like a concept race car-esque rules. And what that would be is almost like, I'm imagining like the auto show conventions where they release those concept cars and that kind of stuff, where now you're seeing some manufacturers making almost one-off like racing versions of some of these prototype cars, that it's more along those lines. And although he tries to hint away from the Halo-style hypercars, it kind of seems like he's hinting at that with some of his quotes.
So something that, along the lines of like the McLaren P1 GTR or the LaFerrari,
the Mercedes,
or something like that.
Yeah. Or even those that Mercedes thing, the Aston Martin. What is that? The
Vulcan.
AMR. Yeah, Vulcan. Yes, some of those kind of, again, Halo cars that, you know, they can have the public's attention in terms of their brand awareness. The interesting thing, I think, from what his topic is now, regardless of how the regs are look in terms visually, the interesting thing is that they're looking at fuel flow regs again, where that they would like to have some brand identification. So if you want a 4-cylinder, 12-cylinder, or whatever you want, you can go with those figures, giving the ability for a range for the manufacturers or teams to just do what they believe is best or what might be best for the brand.
So like Group C?
It kind of feels like that. Aero-wise, and again, he says it the same way. Aero-wise, it will be the same. This is the maximum downforce you can reach that we will measure, and this is the limiting factor. Then you are free to, on the design of the car, but to reach those numbers. So it's almost a bastardization of Group C-esque kind of fuel flow regs, but then also the GT1 era of bodywork design that can match a more road-type car. So they're literally saying, hey, you're only allowed to have this much downforce on the car. After that, you're done. You can't do anything else. So you might as well just design a car that is, you know, has some similarities to a hypercar, halo car version and roll with that. And that's more of an incentive for you to try to sell your brand. So, I mean, this is pretty much whoring out to OEMs. I would love to see how this angle is approached to privateer manufacturers for chassis like Oreca or Ligier, maybe for those. Maybe this is also appealing to them, but there isn't. And they do want to have or try to have customer sales too, which is going to be interesting. I don't know how they're going to do that, but very, very, like, this is radical talk from the FIA. And honestly, reading about it, I'm kind of liking how their ideas are looking if they go on paper the same way. So we'll see.
Yeah.
But I want to give a quick brief discussion on that.
Yep.
I'm skeptical about how much road car silhouette is actually going to transfer. They say there's limiting downforce. So basically the aerodynamic performance is down to, if everyone can get up to that downforce level, it's going to be limited on drag. And so we're going to have still the same slippery looking
prototype
machines.
Cars, yeah.
Yeah. In my opinion, it depends on the amount of downforce they implement. And if, for example, I said on a thread about it on the subreddit, if the supply downforce is low enough, or the ceiling of downforce is low enough for a diffuser to provide that on its own, then we could have the removal of tall rear wings from these cars. Ooh,
that would be a very drastic design change.
They're saying limiting underside downforce, or the like the downforce generated by the underside of the car. So the turning vanes, a lot of that tendency. Yeah. They want to make down, I think, and that's where P2 was a lot, where that they, not necessarily were able to make a lot of downforce from the undertray, but they were able to at least lock that down and go, okay, we're going to probably provide X amount of downforce in the bottom of the car. The rest of the bits not necessarily are extremely important, but you know, they don't serve as much of a purpose because we've been able to naturally generate enough, a lot of downforce in the undertray. That's the only thing I can assume that they're talking about from there. Now, okay. Again, I'm not very savvy when it comes to that, but that's just my guesses is where their ideas are coming from. But again, we'll see. They're even saying, we think we can have it before at Le Mans. So they're not even qualifying that they even have an out if they don't have these done by next week. But I have a feeling we'll still hear about it next week.
Yeah. The interesting thing for me that really strikes me is the fact that they've, going on the DSC article about this, they've said that they're going to restrict the hybrids to a single system, likely only through the front wheels and with a 5 megajoule max. So that would be a reduction on basically all the hybrid systems that we've seen since 2016. I think that was the last year that Audi had a 4 megajoule system, or before that was a 4 megajoule system. And additionally, is a proposal that manufacturer power units, including the hybrid, must be available to non-factory entrants at a set price, I think is the idea. So that is probably going to be very attractive to privateers. However, I'm not exactly sure how that is going to be translated as of yet. This is all very vague and very up in the air at this stage.
Yeah, and I think it's just important. I think that we get we kind of react a little bit to where their ideas are, and I think a lot of it, we just don't have the opportunity to go, hey, this is what they're saying. They're going to be proposing. We can compare it kind of down the road how this is going to work, because if everything works, this should attract a large amount of interest in current manufacturers as well as potential others, maybe privateers if you have that opportunity too. So, I mean, to kind of look at it from where they're starting, I mean, they're at least giving ideas, or at least giving the sense that they understand the tasks that is ahead of them and what they need to try to do to attract more attention to the race. But it remains to be seen kind of how it looks like. And I hope this is the start of at least a lot of intelligent decisions coming for the next regs. So I'm excited though.
Yeah, it is. At least we're seeing some sort of something at this stage. That's been the most exciting part. We're seeing something. But as people are saying in the chat at the moment, we are a little too short on detail. There isn't really much coming out yet. And hopefully, they've said that the ACO have said that they're going to be looking to release something more formal next Friday, which is the rest day before Le Mans. If not, we'll probably get something within the next few months, which is really exciting. But anyway, we've got to get this all ratified by the Motorsport Commission. So this is all just like talking to the fairies at the moment. But at least we're getting something. And we've seen some awesome concept art of like a prototype field featuring Vulcans and McLaren Sennas and Porsche 918s and that sort of stuff. So we could end up seeing something like that, which would be really cool. But then, of course, what happens to the P2? It is all up in the air. But let's talk about something that's a little more concrete, and that is this year's prototype class for the Le Mans 24 Hours. So we've got the two prototype classes, LMP1 and LMP2, of course. And I feel like we can just jump straight into it. In the prototype LMP1 class, we have 10 cars from 4 manufacturers and 6 teams. No, 5 manufacturers and 6 teams. Yeah, you with me so far? Because I'm not. So, of course, we have the two OEM hybrids from Toyota, two Rebellion R13s run by Rebellion, of course, the two Ginettas run by Manor. So we'll be seeing them in action in anger for the first time. And then three BR Engineerings run by SMP Racing and one by Dragon Speed. So sorry, that's two by SMP, one by Dragon Speed. And then finally, Bicolors will be back and are running hopefully properly and not running away after this event again with their Enzo CLM P1, which is actually looking a lot stronger than it has in the past. So where do we want to start, guys?
Up the top with the Toyotas.
Let's start at the top of the Toyotas. So, of course, the Toyotas were the class of the field on Spa, which basically everyone knew was going to happen because they have a hybrid and they've been racing for 7 years in this series.
And Alonso's driving.
And Alonso's driving, but yeah, I think that's less of a factor than
because he's going to win everything.
Okay, yes, we get we get the circle jerk. But yes, the question has been this week, and will be for the rest of the week, how much do Toyota have to push in order to secure victory, and will that result in them shooting themselves in the foot? Because let's not forget, Toyota still haven't won this race, and they've become close for the past 2 years, and even before that as well. They should have won this race last year, and they should have won this race the year before. But yet, here we are again with the question being, will Toyota get to the finish?
I think you really just have to put earplugs on if you're Toyota and just and put blinders on and only focus on your two cars and your own race and just not even worry about where the privateers are at all throughout the entire race, maybe until the last 2 hours, and start worrying about how many laps ahead you are and where the strategy fits. I think Vasselon said it correctly. Toyota is now versus Le Mans. It's not versus anybody else at this point. And it just so happens that Toyota have the fastest car by a pretty good margin, with a best lineup by pretty good margin, in the class.
That's a pretty good margin. I don't quite agree with that.
Fine. Yeah, I guess the cars themselves don't hold up as well as the other. Like, fine. Andre Lorder is a great and talented driver. However, just like, Alan McNish and Tom Christensen and Jackie Ickx, there's timing related to everything. And, I mean, yes, fine. There, he's our Mr. Le Mans right now. But I would still say that there's equal talent on the other side that hasn't won anything. So, but I would still, if I were Toyota, want to not worry about anybody else, anything else, is just focus on your cars overtaking lap traffic, your cars just overtaking cars in the same class, and just running their race until you get to the last 2 hours and then see what's up. Get to 2 hours left with both cars here. You need both of them, 1-2, or else I feel like you're not, I mean, something, is going dastardly wrong, but
and anything can happen at Le Mans.
Has to ignore people.
Anything can happen at Le Mans, and we've said that plenty of times before. This is the Grand Prix of endurance for a reason. You only have to look last year to show that anything can goddamn happen at Le Mans. I mean, the car that won the race spent 100 minutes in the pits repairing a front hybrid. So as you said, the goal for Toyota has to be run their own race and have no problems. That has to be their MO. If they can get to the end of the race, they will win. That's as simple as it gets. But this isn't the first time. This is the first time in the modern era of the WEC, and maybe since 2010 or 2011 or no, sorry, 2012. We'll get there eventually. Where we have seen one team just be absolutely dominant and no one else really have a chance. And that was the last time we really saw that was Audi in 2012 after Peugeot pulled out and Toyota would just scrambled to start their thing way ahead of time and were way off the pace anyway.
2013 was pretty bad too, and Toyota did have a full season there. Audi just whipped them in 2013. Yeah. So.
But looking further afield, while this is the first time in maybe the WEC era that we've seen such a lopsided battle at the front, this isn't true for the rest of Le Mans history. We've seen Porsche, part of the reason Porsche won so many in the mid-70s is because there was just no real distinct competition. I mean, the fastest next guys were like Pescarolo, so not really a full factory effort.
This is still a two-car effort. I mean, they did sign Fernando Alonso, but it's still a two-car effort. I mean, fine that they lost three cars last year, but if they were the empire, they would have brought three cars. So I think this is absolutely within the grasp of privateers to clean this up, because Toyota do not have anything on their CV that even indicates that they're going to have both cars on the lead lap you know, by the end of the race. They should not. They should have probably both cars in the garage. So,
and statistically, that's right. True. Right. Only so, two cars out of their 13 that they've brought to Le Mans have finished the race without problems.
Or being well off the pace. Because, I mean, in 2015, both Toyotas finished, but they were so far down the order that it wasn't even relevant to the race anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, podium finishes are fine, but when they're always bronze, I don't know if that's an achievement sometimes.
Well, I mean, Toyota have been hunting that top step, so that's right, what yeah, they're looking for.
Right, right. And they're still giving themselves a chance to fail with this. So I would just say, just even with the pace difference, this is going to be a really interesting race to see what happens with Toyota.
The thing that should play very well in their favor, though, is the EOT, and we'll talk properly about EOT once we get to the end of the privateers in this class. But they will have a distinct advantage, not only just over a single lap, which we saw in testing, maybe not by much in a single lap, but over a stint, they should be able to just walk away from everything. So we're saying should, not will, because anything can happen at Le Mans.
And it usually does.
So we'll move on now to talk about probably the best place, the privateers, the rebellions. The number one and the number three car will be dressed up in the rebellion tiger light livery or zebra or something. I don't know what they're calling it. But the two rebellions were definitely the strongest of the privateers at Spa, the strongest of the privateers at the test day, and they do have, in my opinion, one of the best driver lineups in the class in one of their cars, and then a very, very strong driver lineup in the other car, featuring in the number one, Andre Lotterer, Neil Jani, and Bruno Senna, and in the number three, Thomas Laurent, Matthias Besch, and Gustavo Menezes. So those are some pretty competitive cars, just looking at the names behind them. But when you add to that the fact that it's a well-established chassis, a well-established engine, and a well-established team in the WEC, they should be the closest to winning overall if it doesn't end up being a Toyota, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I think the number one car, the drivers have got the most experience about passing traffic, and that could be the difference between privateers.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Oh, they're by far. If the Toyota stumble, they will probably be the first privateer to jump up on the top step here. Unless the SMPs kind of pull something out of their collective hats, or the BR1s pull something out of their collective hats. It just looks like the Rebellion chassis is by far the fastest privateer, or at least consistently throughout the entire lap. I think the SMPs will just be flying by people on the straights, but the rest of their lap time does not translate. So
I'm not so sure about how easily they're going to pass traffic, though, because what we've been become accustomed to is the hybrid punch out of the corner quickly dispatching the slower cars, whereas it's only 100 brake horsepower and a bit lower weight between P2s and privateer P1s. So they're going to be waiting to pass a bit longer. They might be taking risks in short straights, like, for example, up before Tetra Rouge, maybe they're going to lunge through and take a risk. Whereas the Toyotas can just press the button and push to pass nice and easy.
You're right. Yeah. And I now counter that with at the end of the straight when they need to brake, it's a lot more tough for the P1s outside of, you know, when you're not under fire from someone in the same, in your same class, you're definitely going to have your ability to kind of pick your lines, and it's going to be a slower overtake at the end of the break, at the end of the straight, but you're overtaking cars, so they're able to see you. It'll be interesting because we haven't seen privateers this fast. We haven't seen actual prototypes, naturally aspirated prototypes without any hybrid technology, be this competitively fast at Le Mans years. So I think momentum through the corners will be a big thing the privateers want to do, relatively speaking. I mean, that sounds crazy in these hugely fast and powerful prototypes, but I think that would be a big thing too. How can you maintain the speed through your corner so that you have the fastest exit speed to try to keep up with these hybrids and to try to, like you said, give a little bit of an edge over the non-hybrid cars for overtaking cars right out of the corner. So I still think that you're going to have a better punch at the end of the straight, but a lot of that's negligible when you hit the braking zone anyway, a lot of these corners at Le Mans. So
interestingly, looking at the top speed from the test day, the speed trap at Le Mans is immediately before the first chicane on the Mulsanne straight. The only cars from LMP1 that were faster than the LMP2 cars, the head of the LMP2 field, were the two BR1 engineering, BR engineerings from SMP and the Toyota hybrid, driven by Mike Conway. So only one of them. The top of the LMP2 field, G Drive Racing and, Panis Barthez were actually faster than all of the other LMP1 cars. And that's a Ligier and a Orica. So trying to pass the LMP2 cars, as Trevor sort of said, without the hybrid on the corner exit is going to be very difficult on those long straights. But I think the most important thing about the driver lineups for the Rebellions is that everyone here has proper Le Mans experience. We've talked about Londre Lotterer and Neil Jarny already, in terms of their LMP1 efforts with Porsche, and with Audi before that. But even if you look at the rest of the field, Bruno Senna, Matthias Besch, Thomas Laurent, and Gustavo Menezes, all four of them last year were racing in the LMP2 class. So they have the experience of passing slower traffic, and they have the experience of navigating between difficult situations in traffic. So I think that is going to be a strength for them over some of the drivers in Toyota, because Fernando Alonso has only done two endurance races, so he's still, traffic is still a thing that he has, needs to learn to contend with, because it's not something you learn immediately. And I still don't think Jose Maria Lopez is as strong in the traffic as he needs to be able to anchor an LMP1 team. So if it's going to come down to, being able to navigate traffic, like in the night, for example, which is something that Alonso hasn't done, proper darkness, because let's be real here, Daytona, it never really gets properly dark because you're always under lights. But the drivers for the Rebellions are going to have an upper hand in that respect, at least.
Yeah. I mean, when you pull the hair that way, it works. Then we definitely have to give the strength to Bicols when we get to them as well, because they've been at Le Mans, a few years, even though they haven't really raced a whole ton. But, the Fernando Alonso bit, I agree. Yes. He doesn't understand specifically how to overtake traffic as best as somebody like Neil Jarny or Andre Lotter, just from their experience and time behind the wheel. But, he touts himself as a world-class athlete. We've literally changed the schedule for him. I'm going to hold him to a higher standard that he's going to figure this out.
Oh, yeah, quickly. Definitely. Definitely, you're going to hold him to a higher standard, but he might not have the edge that someone like a Jarny or a Lotterer will have. You did mention Bicolors. Do you want to move on to Bicolors right now?
Yeah, let's do it.
So Bicolors are back with their number 4 Enzo CLM P1/01. This is the car driven by the old Nissan Nissan LM whatever it was engine, the one that was in the front wheel drive prototype that died constantly. But I am actually quite excited for this car because a few of the drivers who have driven this car have said that the engine in this car is the best LMP1 engine that they have ever driven, including people like Felipe Albuquerque and Marco Bonanomi, ex-Audi LMP1 drivers. So this is going to be a car to be reckoned with the long straights that we have at Le Mans. They finished fourth in the opening round at Spa. After the Rebellion number 1 got disqualified, of course. But with the driver lineup of Oliver Webb, who has, raced in this car before, Dominic Kreiheimer again in this car before, and Tom Dillman, rounding out that car, it is going to be at least a competitive car, if not, maybe one that will be a step below the Rebellions.
Yeah, could be. It could be. Like you said, they've got a pretty bad voodoo with this event, not too good finish numbers, and even the drivers themselves. I looked at Ollie Webb and Kreiheimer's history, and Kreiheimer has 7 starts with 5 in P1, but only finished one of them. And
were all of them with this car though? Because this car hasn't finished all of them in its entire
life. I don't think he's done P1 outside of Bicolis. So, and then Ollie Webb, he got a class podium in 2014, but DNF'd ever since. So, yeah.
Again, probably because this car is the problem. And I think the worst thing about the Bicolor's operation so far is that had they finished last year, they probably would have won because all of the hybrids ahead of them had problems. But they had a problem on the first lap, and that was it. They were out for the entire race. And they didn't come back to the World Endurance Championship after that event, which was a bit crap, to be honest, because we were expecting them to, you know, at least stick around. But it looks like now they've actually got a car that's competitive in the P1 privateer class after being bitch-slapped by Rebellion for 4 years straight. And
they're still going to get bitch-slapped by Rebellion.
I mean, to be fair, they still might, but at least they're faster than the P2 cars.
Yes.
Because that's what we were worried about last year. We were saying that the Bicolor's car was so slow in testing that they might not even be faster than the P2 cars. But now it definitely is. It definitely looks like it has some semblance of reliability for a change. It might not catch on fire. It's still going to be in the bingo square, but it might not. So we could see them actually have a decent result. They were 7th in the test day. 2 seconds away from the SMP racing cars, but, you know, this is Le Mans. 2 seconds down doesn't really mean nothing.
I mean, they also have a measuring stick, too. I mean, you got Dragon Speed, who I would almost put in around the same category as like, a fledgling operation. Although, I'd say Dragon Speed has a more reliable chassis in terms of, like, I feel like its chassis is much more developed to exist for 24 hours than, I think, the CLM is. But we'll see. We'll see. Outside of that, the improved pace is just a sigh of relief, at least for me, who enjoyed watching them at least try to race.
At least like, try.
As much as car didn't want to. Right. Yeah. They're just like, please car work. Like, just, no, it just doesn't want to. But, right. I really hope that, we see this car through the night and maybe into the morning. It'd be great to, you know, actually see it running still, and maybe hopefully not 20 laps down, although I have a feeling this is going to be, it's going to be a long race for them, but I hope that they can get to the finish with this car.
Look, I honestly hope that they will get to the finish. I hope they get to the finish, and I know that it will feel like a win for that team because this car hasn't gotten to the finish for so long. And if they do get to the finish, they'll get a, you know, decent top 7-ish sort of result. Because, yeah, I don't think they've got the outright ability to beat the SMP guys, but I do think that they're going to be better than the Dragon Speed P1 car and probably the Ginettas.
Ooh, that's interesting. See, I'm thinking the Ginettas are going to be faster than the
really
Michaels.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the Ginettas might even sneak up by the S&Ps. We'll see.
Well, do we want to talk about Ginetta then? Because this will be Ginetta's first actual outing in the P1 class after their problems at Spa with the money flow problems. So the two Ginettas are run by Mana Team. The full name is Mana CEFC TRSM Racing. So this will be their Ginetta competition debut. They're running the Mechachrome engines. And they've got I'd say one of their cars has a much stronger driver lineup than the other. I'd reckon the 6 with Oliver Rowland, Alex Brundle, and Oliver Turvey behind the wheel is going to be much, much better than the Charlie Robertson, Michael Simpson, Leo Russell number 5, although Leo Russell is definitely a good pickup for them. But they didn't have the best of the test days. The question for them at the test day was, were they going to be better than the LMP2 class? And they just edged them out, I think. We still have absolutely no indication on where this car's pace actually sits. A rumor has it that they do have a low downforce kit somewhere coming along this week. Whether or not that actually happens is going to be a different story.
If it's going to be allowed or not as well.
So why wouldn't it be allowed?
Well, we don't know if it has been homologated. They have to submit paperwork a certain time before an event for it to be signed off, and we don't know how late the design process was. It's a similar system to the SMP had to ask for special allowance to change their modifications because technically it's running outside of the homologation.
Yeah,
because you're modifying the bodywork. So this sort of modification has to be checked. Yeah. And we don't know if that paperwork was submitted in time or not.
And it looks like the genetic car has just gone through scrutineering, because while we're recording this, scrutineering is going on live right now. So it might actually be already too late for that car to get a proper LMP1 low downforce kit. And I was wrong, sorry. They were stationed behind two of the LMP2 cars in testing, behind the Dragon Speed number one, the Dragon Speed number 31 and the IDEX Sport number 48 car. A full 8 seconds off the pace of the Toyotas, and a full second behind the next slowest LMP1 car, which was the Dragon Speed car. So, Cookie, do you really want to stick behind the Ginettas are going to be up with the SMP racing car, which was 7 seconds a lap faster than them?
Yeah, I mean, sort of, yeah. I mean, I feel like there's more pace that Ginetta have that they'll find through the race than the other privateer teams, I just feel like. So, but then again, they could all just break in the first 3 hours. So, we won't know, because we really haven't seen these cars race ever at all. And Le Mans is probably crazy. They'll be there, I think, in the 6 hour mark. What position? I think they'll be ahead of the LMP2s, but we'll see. We'll see. This is just so open, and I do think that they have pace. It'll just be interesting to see how they use it.
Yeah, I think for this, the whole modus operandi sort of thing about the privateers coming in over last year is, if you're faster than an LMP2 and have good reliability, you can win the race.
That was that was the case for the privateers last year, though.
Yeah, but even more so with more lenient rules to try and encourage some more people to join. So, to be honest, if they can keep above LMP2s, then they're pretty successful. Yeah,
their attempts at running at Le Mans. And I think for their first race, let's not forget, their first race in the WEC, they're getting to the finish ahead of the LMP2 field will be an achievement for this Ginetta car. It will at least give them some momentum moving into the second half of the season with some money behind them, hopefully with the sponsorship money actually coming in and allowing them to develop the car. So I reckon the goal for Ginetta will be get to the end of the race ahead of the LMP2 field. At least if I was Ginetta, that would be what my goal was.
And see how many in front of you stay in the pits.
Yeah, fingers crossed. So we will now move to the last chassis of the prototype field, the BR Engineering BR1, and we'll talk through the Dragon Speed car first. This car has a special dispensation to race in the WEC this year because of the driver lineup, specifically because it features a bronze driver, that of Heinrich Hedman. With him is longtime co-driver Ben Hanley, and from the States, well, at least from racing in the States, Renger van der Zander. Now, do we hold any hope that this car is going to finish towards the top?
No.
No.
Why?
Well, Heinrich Hedman, his pace...
quote-unquote pace.
Well, yeah, it's multiple seconds a lap slower per lap. Spreading that over his stint length is going to be... He's going to be losing laps just in his within his driving time. So his whole, you know, their whole option of winning is everyone else fails sort of thing. Their main goal, they have said, their main goal is to be faster than LMP2s.
That's a pretty decent goal. And remember, for them, this is also going to be their first race after their Pietro Fittipaldi's accident at Spa-Francorchamps in qualifying. So this will be the first race for Dragon Speed for the WEC in LMP1. Heinrich Hedman, we've said already and we'll say again, is going to be a literal anchor dragging this car down towards the ground. But I am interested to see Ben Hanley and especially Renger van der Zander, how they perform in this car and if they can match the sort of race lap times of the likes of the SMP Racing BR1s.
Ben Hanley was tearing it up in ELMS. Hasn't he had every race start so far this season.
Yeah, and they've got Nicolai Lapierre in that car as well. So that's a proper team in the LMS.
I think even not even mentioned is that as long as they keep up just a decent amount of pace, they'll be a pretty nice rolling landmine for any other P2s or GTs or LMP1s or anything like that. That potentially, you know, they can at least provide more requirement of skill to get around or something like that. Even if not, I think they'll be fine throughout most of the race. I just think they'll be kind of out pasture.
I just hope Hanley doesn't do a Vaxivier and knock a car into the barriers down the Mulsanne.
I have a gut feeling that this car will be involved in something like that come race day, but we'll see. And I just maybe we'll see some sparks of brilliance from Van de Zand. So we'll see if that comes around at some point too. But I feel like this is a solid chassis, solid engine that will probably last the whole race. It's just whether or not the drivers that are driving it want to
last the whole race. Okay, moving on then to the BR engineer, two other BR engineering cars, the S&P Racing cars, the number 11, the number 17. 17 has former Toyota LMP1 driver Stefan Sarrazin, and then the two Russians, Edgar Oruzadov and Mateus Izakian. Matevos Izakian. I probably got both of those names horribly wrong. And then in the number 11 car, we've got former F1 driver Vitaly Petrov, Russian prototype maestro Mikhail Elation, and former F1 driver Jenson Button, making his first WEC appearance ever.
Well, I mean, we finally gave him an opportunity too, because he didn't want to do all the technical hybrid stuff. So we finally got him a dummy car or a dumb car.
Wow. I bet the guys at BR Engineering are real happy to hear you say that.
Well, you know, shout out to my boys there at SMP Racing. Gotta love my Russian. But great for the sport. We pulled another driver in that a lot of people like to follow, and he has a nice video vlog that he likes to make. So promoting the sport, I'll take it. And his tire management is bar anyone, I think, especially in Formula One. You saw a lot of his ability to manage the car that he's driving very, very well, even better than what people would tout as potentially some of the greatest racing drivers that we've seen in Formula One. So I do think that he will add a lot instead of detract from that team. And it remains to be seen where S&P's pace really lies compared to Rebellion. But I think if Rebellion slips that car, especially the 11 or the 17, but mostly the 11 will probably be able to pick up the pieces. So That's my potential podium finishing car if everything goes wrong for Rebellion and Toyota.
I'd agree with that. You know what we said about Alonso having to fight through traffic in the Toyota? That problem is going to be compounded for Jenson Button, because this is his first endurance race ever in a sports car. He hasn't done
Super
Daytona.
GT.
Or Super GT, yeah, I guess, but still, the speed difference isn't quite the same between the Super GT 500 class and the GT 300 class. At least, I don't think. I'm more interested to see how Fernando Alonso tries to get past Vitaly Petrov, because if anyone remembers the 2010 Formula One season, that was probably... it was the reason that Vettel won the championship that year. It's because Fernando Alonso couldn't get past Vitaly Petrov.
Yeah, the entire race. I remember that one.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll be... I'm sure Fernando, when he's overtaking everything, just shouts expletives or something like that. I can just imagine like some Spaniard expletive flying out from him from any overtake, but maybe he'll shout too for Petrov. But
what I'd love to see is... To Alonso overtaking Petrov at the start of a straight section on the Mulsanne, but then the highest speed of the BR engineering car overtaking just before the braking zone and blocking him for a whole lap. That's what I want to see.
That's like a Renault F1 fan's wet dream, or a Red Bull fan's wet dream.
Just bang on the LED laser lights just constantly, see if you can give him.
See, that was Alonso's problems. He didn't have the headlights to switch on and off in that Abu Dhabi race. Anyway,
that's key.
So you made mention of something there, Trevorosaurus, which I think is very important. Of all the cars in the test day in the P1 class, the SMP Racing BR1 Dallara seems to have the best straight line speed and the most consistent straight line speed out of all of them. So while the Toyota was at the top of the charts with a 338 kilometer speed trap, the second Toyota was at 328. So that's a pretty big speed difference. And I'd say the 28 is more likely for the rest of, for most of the race. But the SMP Racing cars were getting their cars up to that 337, 336 kilometers per hour down the Mulsanne straight sort of level. So serious, serious speeds. And yeah, that will probably be, that scenario that you spelt out of a Toyota passing a BR engineering car right at the beginning, only to have it pass back at the end of the straight, will probably happen at least once.
And to note as well, the Toyota and a lot of the trap speeds can also just be from how much deployment they're using. So, I mean, if the trap speed is at a certain sector and the test day, Mike Conway saw there's a Trent GT cars that was heading into, what is it, Mulsanne Corner? He holds the go fast button for a little bit longer at the end of the straight. It's still supplying electrical power. The car's still accelerating. It's not like it's hitting this capped speed where, you know, you have the privateers where they just physically, there's no ability for them to go faster. If there's more juice, the Toyota's just going to go faster until it basically hits its max gear ratio. So, I think the Toyota is slower than what the speed trap is in terms of an average speed.
Yeah, this is what something that I commented on an article I put together after the test day. The fastest lap measured that day was done by the number 8 car, and the fastest speed trap across the whole day was the 10 kilometers an hour slower. So a race representative lap or a qualifying lap will have a slower top speed.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, as Cookie said earlier, these cars are probably the next cars down after Rebellion. So the kind of hierarchy in P1 at the moment is Toyota with Rebellion snapping at its heels, and then SMP BR1 kind of snapping at Rebellion's heels. So yeah, if there are problems, expect these cars to sort of jump onto the podium. So which do you think is the stronger of the two lineups for the SMP cars?
Good question. I think the button car.
The number 11?
Yeah. Yep.
What about you, Cookie?
It's just race experience, number 11. I mean, they Alation has been slightly every now and then, kind of an Indy car. And Petrov kind of obviously kind of burst in and then faded out pretty quick. But that's just so much talent. And I mean, 17's got it, but on paper, they look to be better.
I would agree with the number 11, but what does interest me about the 17 is that you have two relative young guys partnered up with Stefan Sarrazin, one of the elder stalwarts of prototype racing at Le Mans. So if anyone's going to be able to teach these young guys how to race at Le Mans, it's going to be Sarrazin. And I think that's a fantastic driver lineup in terms of transfer of ideas and transfer of knowledge. So we should see Egor Oruzev, I'll get it right eventually, and Mateva Sizakian really learning a lot from Sarrazin at Le Mans.
Last thing about this, I think it's really interesting that this is a through and through Russian outfit. Like, I just expected a little bit of kind of a European flair like you always do, but I mean, this is just a...
Well, European flair, Sarrazin and Button, that's a European flair on it. And they're running
it is, but there's four out of the six drivers are Russians, which I would have expected from the S&P outfit. When they went to P1, I didn't think that they were going to try to just be very nationalistic, which, hey, I can appreciate that. You don't see that very often, so I don't know.
Yeah, and I think S&P have always sort of been very nationalistic. I mean, their P2 class last year had Alation, Sergei Shirotkin, and Viktor Shaitar behind the wheel, so they've found more Russian drivers. They keep finding them. So that kind of wraps up the prototype class, for the P1 class. So let's do our favorite thing in the world. Let's do some predictions. So, who do you reckon is going to win overall?
It's tough because you have no idea what's going to happen, in terms of, reliability.
Yep.
But if it's dry, if it's not too hot, then,
if an FIA wiring loom doesn't melt.
Yeah, exactly. One of the Toyotas. I'm going to go with Fernando Alonso, because Fernando Alonso's car, the number 8, because if there is any politics involved with both cars going trouble free, then there might be an expectation of having one car put in front of the other.
Wow, that's not cynical at all. That's not cynical at all. What about you, Cookie?
You know what? I mean, if you pinned me to and asked me the same question, I might give the same response. I do kind of think the number 7 might be the faster of the two chassis, but if all in variables kind of work out in Toyota's favor, I just feel like the 8 will be ahead somehow, some way. But the way that looking at what Spa was and kind of just drive live with the 7, I could easily see them having pace over the 8 too. So, it's 24 hours. So, I mean, all this could be for naught within hour 12 in terms of who's going to be here at the end. But I mean, I would want to give a nod to the number 8, because who's in the driver lineup and that they do match up pretty close to the 7. But politics kind of came into effect last race.
See, I would agree with the 8, but not for a political reason. I think that, I reckon Buemi and Conway and Nakajima and Kobayashi are pretty much interchangeable, but I reckon that Fernando Alonso is going to be better than Jose Maria Lopez. I still don't rate Jose Maria Lopez as an out-and-out LMP1 driver. I think he's got definite quality that we saw in patches last year, but over an entire race, I think Alonso will outstrip Lopez relatively easily. On top of that, I still can't trust Conway. He's extremely inconsistent when he gets in the car. He'll either have an absolutely stonking stint like he did at Spa, or he'll run into 3 or 4 P2 cars and earn a penalty and a half. So I'm going to say the number 8. Now, who's going to be the top after the Toyotas?
The number 1.
Yeah, number 1.
I'm going to be different. I'm going to say the number 11. So,
Nice.
Let's do it. That's our predictions for P1. Watch us be extremely wrong and see the number 7 win, followed by the number 3, then the number 17, like we did last year, where literally none of us picked the winning car. So, we're going to...
go. Well, I mean, I'm Toyota till I die. So, I mean, that might be a long time.
True endurance chat spirit, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
So we have made it abundantly clear that we think the Toyotas are going to just walk away with the event should they not run into any problems. Telling thing about the event. But there is something that we do want to make clear about this, and that is the fact that the EOT kind of dictates this. Now, if you haven't already seen, part of the Le Mans Primer post that I put up on the Reddit sub every year has a fantastic explanation of the context and requirements of the equivalence of technology in the prototype class, and that was written up by Baxter. So big shout out to Baxter for writing this, and you should definitely have a read of it. I'm just going to pull out the most important details. The first part is that the whole idea of the equivalence of technology was to allow cars of different fuel types and different hybrid capacities to be able to race against each other in a competitive way. So this was drafted up in the time where we had Toyota with a naturally aspirated V6 petrol hybrid with a supercapacitor, Audi with a, I think it was a turbocharged V8 diesel, maybe, or a 6-cylinder diesel, some sort of diesel, I can't really quite remember, with a flywheel hybrid, and Porsche, who entered with a twin turbocharged V4 with a battery hybrid system running petrol. So they were three entirely different philosophies on how to create a LMP1 car power plant with a hybrid, and the equivalence of technology was designed to be able to say that the maximum available output from any of those three combinations would be at around the same level. But built into this was an incentive for teams and the manufacturers to actually try and build bigger and bigger hybrid systems and try to maximize the capacity that they could use. So the idea was that for every megajoule of hybrid that you added onto the car, you should be able to increase your lap time if you at a maximum capacity by about a half a second a lap. So in theory, an 8 megajoule capacity hybrid car should be able to be a second faster than the 6 megajoule capacity, second faster than 4, etc., etc., etc. But of course, with that, you have to sacrifice engineering in other ways because you're building a bigger capacity hybrid. It means we need better cooling, blah, 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 blah. So what we ended up with was three of the best years of prototype racing that's ever been happening around the world ever, in my opinion. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it just seemed to work. But now without Porsche and without Audi, the EOT philosophy has kind of had to change in order to bring the privateers closer to this 8 megajoule hybrid capacity Toyota that has had 7 years of racing experience in the WEC. The way it's done that is that as a consequence of not having a hybrid, the privateer cars are allowed more fuel per stint and a higher instantaneous fuel flow over the course of the race. So they should theoretically be able to produce more power in the ICE, but as a consequence, they are also using more fuel. All of this generally rounds out to about a one-lap stint advantage per stint for Toyota, and at about 0.5% faster pace per lap for Toyota. Now, people have been up in arms about the EOT mostly because of the fact that there's this line in the regulations that say that should a privateer car exceed this 0.5% threshold in terms of pace, they will penalize the privateer car to ensure that the EOT standard, that 0.5%, is maintained. Because of the context of what the EOT was trying to do, I can understand why that is, and I can also understand why people are up in arms about it. But the reality is, there should be no way that the Toyota should lose this race. Because they've had this car developed for so long, they've been racing in this class for the last 7 years, there is no way that a brand new privateer car should be able to outstrip the Toyota. It just wouldn't make sense. And that's what this EOT is trying to maintain, and I think it's fair enough.
Well, because it's not BOP, so they're trying to structure it so that they don't, that it is more of a hands-off approach, and that they go, here's the regulations, here's how you fit into them, here's how you make it work. And they're still to the point, even in the last interviews that they've had, that they that this is all within acceptable deltas, acceptable parameters, that that there is pace to be found in the privateers, that they are making the I think the correct assumption that they will find that pace at some point. And you don't just get the magic pace button as soon as the green flag drops. There is development that needs to happen, that it would happen anyway regardless if you gave them an extra dispensation to be a little bit faster. So I think this is right for the FIA to do. It's not going to feel equal. I mean, we're not coming into here going, this is like NASCAR or Formula One right now. We have Ferrari and Mercedes and even Red Bull going back and forth, and you don't know who's necessarily going to win each weekend. Le Mans is kind of a little bit decided in terms of where we know the pace is, but next year and potentially in November and December and in March next year, the pace should be extremely close between the privateers and Toyota in terms of where their overall pace should be, I believe.
Because the,
so
the privateers,
I think this is a good idea.
Because the privateers will have the option to develop their cars further, whereas Toyota are limited in that quite a bit. An important point that Baxter does bring up in that little discussion post is that the gap between the non-hybrids and the Toyota before they adjusted the EOT for this year was over 5 seconds at Spa-Francorchamps. This year, it was 1.5 at a maximum between the Rebellion and the Toyota. So they've done a massive job in trying to close that gap to what should be a fair amount. Now, what this does mean in the end is that should Toyota trip up, should they get involved in an incident, should they have mechanical drama, should they run a pit stop, like speed in a pit stop and earn a penalty, the Rebellions and the rest of the prototype field and the privateers should be directly on their case. So this EOT gap, yes, it does favor the Toyota, but the idea is it shouldn't favor them that much. And should we see Toyota trip at all, it should turn into a fantastic contest.
And yeah, I should also add the refueling time is slightly different because the Toyotas have a smaller fuel tank. And like you said, the privateers have more fuel available. If they were refueling at the same rate of fuel going in per second, they would lose about 17 seconds for the privateers over the Toyotas because there's that much fuel, more fuel going into the car. So they, to help balance it, they've opened up the fuel rig restrictor to then reduce the difference to about 7 seconds, but still that's not equalizing. That's still providing an advantage to Toyota over a stint plus pit stop added together. So yeah, what do you think about that?
Look, I can see why that would annoy a lot of people. I think the gap should be a little closer. It should maybe be like 3 or 4 seconds as opposed to 7, but it does, because Toyota have the hybrid, it does mean that they will have an intrinsic advantage, and the ACO should try to retain that, I think. But, you know, the Toyotas aren't going to have it all their own way. We've already made mention of the fact that the Rebellions were extremely good in the first stint, the first sector at Le Mans, the high downforce area. But the BR engineering cars are going to be much quicker than Mulsanne. So the Toyota isn't actually going to be the quickest car in any sector of the track. It might be in sector 3 where you have a combined run from Arnage and then the Porsche curves, but the Toyota isn't going to be the fastest car around the entire track. It's going to be the fastest over a lap, but other cars are going to be in its way and competing with it. Or at least, you know, getting in the eye line. So the pit stop thing does annoy me a little bit, but I can understand again why it happens.
Yeah, and going off that also, people have been doing simulations of a full race distance, and these times saved going one lap per stint longer and spending less time in the pits, the cars, the Toyotas will have if it's perfect conditions around 2 lap advantage at the end of the race. So that is equivalent to seven and a bit minutes. So actually, that's not that much time. Like you said,
That's
a drive through or something.
Yeah, that's basically exactly the same as the advantage that Porsche had over Audi in 2015. Where Porsche won the race by 2 laps.
Yep.
So yeah, it is just the advantage of having a better car. Maybe the regulations have defined that they will have a better car, but honestly, as I've said, because they've been the only hybrid, because they've been racing here for seven seasons, and because the privateers have had to get this big step up to catch up to the hybrid, then yeah, I can see why. So yeah, any other final comments on EOT?
Let's just see what happens.
Yep.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be down to, we've got a structure. Let's see if everybody kind of fits in it. But I do agree with that. There might be some other variables like pit stop length and other things that maybe the FIA didn't fully consider when drafting some of this stuff. But I still feel like this is close enough where you will definitely have pressure on Toyota.
And this is a unique track as well. So this isn't like a Spa-Francorchamps or like a Nürburgring or like a Silverstone. This is entirely unique in the fabric of sports cars. So it's not like something that you do elsewhere will work here. There will be some level of trial and error, and we might even see the EOT get adjusted before the race. And like, I know I wouldn't like to see it, but I kind of think I'd be okay with it if it was that bad. Yeah, this is just kind of the way it has to be for this year. Maybe we'll see different next year or next season. But yeah, it does mean that Toyota need to be pretty much perfect. And yeah, hopefully they should be. I mean, for cookie's sake.
One more thing quickly before we move on. Because of the pit stop, talking of pit stops, because of the pit stop rules have slightly changed where the tyres can be done at the same time as refueling, the total pit stop time you'd expect to be shorter. that means that there's longer, more time out on track. Do you think that these cars, these Toyotas or whoever wins, would break the distance record?
Potentially, yeah. It will depend on the lap times and it will depend on the weather. But we did see the cars push up towards 400 laps over the past few years. So if they are spending more time on track, if they are going to be putting in more consistent lap times at the very head of the field, then we could see that 400 lap marker get broken. And if Paul Truswell starts getting excited about it, you could probably say that it's going to happen. Just quickly, it's an interesting point you pick up there on the Toyotas, the fuel and the tires having to be done at the same time, because that means that the Toyotas will have a lot less margin of error in putting the tires on and getting their driver changes done than the privateers as well. So that might be why that 7 second buffer is there for the privateers, to make sure that they can do their pit stops at a much more comfortable rate than the Toyotas.
And there is a precedent, or there's history with, poor driver changes in Toyota in recent history, because at Spa, was it Nakajima who didn't have his belts done? So effectively, had a stop-go penalty, effectively, because he had to come in the next lap, stop, open the door, fix the belts, and then go out again. So that's worse than a stop-go.
Yeah, exactly. And finally, to just wrap up on P1, for those who haven't read that EOT post, it is linked in the Le Mans Primer. You should definitely have a read of it. It does a much better job of explaining everything than what I did. Props again to Baxter for having for putting that together for us. That kind of wraps up the Prototype 1 class at Le Mans. So moving on straight away then into Prototype 2. This is the Pro-Am class for the prototypes. So the driver regulations for this states that at least one bronze or silver driver must be in any driver, any car. These cars are all the same Gibson engine and drivetrain, and one of three chassis this year. So we have the Orica, the Ligier, and the Dallara. I think we actually have more of the Ligiers this year than we do of the Oricas. So farewell, LMP Orica. It's time for an actual fully-fledged LMP2 class at Le Mans, which is super exciting, I feel. And on top of that, with Ligier bringing their low downforce kit for the first time, and Dallara having a new kit which doesn't have the instability issues, we could actually see a proper competition between the three chassis at Le Mans for the first time, which is extremely exciting, I feel.
Well, based on the test day, now it is testing, so times aren't exactly representative, but the Oricas were the best package to be on. Still, and the Ligiers weren't posting the best times, but it is positive going forward. And also in the rules, there is a BOP ability to slow down the fastest car. They won't increase the speed of the slower cars, but they reserve the right to reduce the speed of the top cars. So that could still happen, I guess, before the race starts.
Well, I mean, you say that might be the case, but in terms of just looking at the speed traps, for example, we had a Orica and a Ligier have the two fastest speed trap speeds for LMP2, and then a Dallara was only about 4 or 5 kilometers off the pace, and I reckon those top two speeds might have been cars going straight on at that first chicane. So they are pretty equal in terms of top speed. And even in a testing, we saw a Ligier only just off the top of the Oricas, and a Dallara only, all three chassis were featured within the top six, which was about a 2 second gap. But towards the end of the session, there were some hero times put in by Jean-Éric Vergne, Matteo Vaxiviere, and Nicolas Lapierre in particular. So we will have to wait and see, but I feel like we could see a much closer spread between the three chassis come the actual race. So we should crack on into some of the teams and drivers. So let's see how we go. So we'll go from the very top. United Autosports are bringing along two Ligiers from the European Le Mans Series. Their AM drivers, in the 22, we have Phil Hansen, and in the 32, we have both Hugo de Salia and Will Owen. And their pro drivers will be Felipe Albuquerque and former F1 drivers Paul de Resta and Juan Pablo Montoya. So a massive, that's a really exciting driver lineup for that car, because we have another former F1 driver in, like, a high quality former F1 driver jumping around in these cars.
Another one of the 23 former 23. F1 drivers.
It's crazy.
Yeah, so, I think they're the best, looking to be the best Ligiers in terms of driver talent, and you could argue in terms of team talent and in the pits.
Oh, definitely. United Autosport have been the class of the field for the Ligiers in both the European Le Mans Series and when they take them over to the IMSA WeatherTech North American Endurance Cup. So if any Ligier is going to be the competitive ones, it's going to be these two.
Yeah.
Cookie, anything you wanted to add?
No, pretty much. You guys nailed most of it for this, for the United Autosport effort. I mean, this is a solid lineup for both cars, in my opinion, and both with, I think, a good mesh of drivers and skills sets. The 32 will probably have contact and will finish behind the 22 regardless of where they end up, just because I have yet to see Juan Montoya not scare the absolute bejesus out of me when he overtakes anything. So, again, this the closest dude I ever see to just ever, you know, binning it consistently every lap against the overtaking GT car. So, outside of that, they have fantastic pace, and it just remains to be seen how the Ligier is in comparison to Dallara and Orica.
I reckon you're right about the 32, and also the fact that they've got two silvers in that car might slow them down a little bit. But it just, like, Felipe Albuquerque is a former Audi development driver for the LMP1 program, so he's definitely quality. I mean, Paul de Resta never really, like, rooted himself as a fully fledged F1 driver, and I mean that he never really seemed secure in always having a seat, like, say, someone like a Nico Hülkenberg might have. But he's definitely got quality, and I think very recently ran away with the DTM round in, was it Hockenheim, where he was just unbeatable. If you're gunning for a Ligier, these would be the first two shots in the gun, I reckon. Next one in the gun, based on some recent testing times, maybe, is the number 23 Panis Barthez competition car of Timothy Bourret, Julian Canal, and Will Stevens. Is Panis Barthez bringing along a second car? It does not look like they are.
No, I don't think so, no.
Which is a shame, because I'd love to see Mr. Barthez, Fabian Barthez, get into the Le Mans spirit again. Former Manchester United goalkeeper, of course, and that holds a very special place in my heart, because Manchester United is the best.
Whoa! But yes, Man U, go you. Yeah, yes. But beyond that, I think it's good. Will Stevens, another former F1 talent.
And also a Le Mans winner. He won the GTM class last year with JMW Motorsport.
Yep. So he knows how to, yeah. Knows how to get his done.
So another quality car. Again, two silvers, though, might be a little bit of a handicap, but you can kind of counteract that with Will Stevens, I think. And this car was the... whereabouts was it in testing? It was 23rd, so it suits its number, because it's number 23, so there you go. But that's overall, of course, not in the LMP2 class. In LMP2 itself, it was just outside the top 10, in 13th, so... not massively on the pace, but, you know, kind of mid-pack.
Solid P2 entry.
Do we expect much from this car?
No, not from the front, I don't think. I think it's a good midfield car. Yeah. Well, it remains to be seen how the silver's, but Canal's good. I think he's a good silver. Barrett will be interesting to see his pace.
It also remains to be seen what the Michelin tyres are going to be like. This is one of the few cars, I think five total, yeah, running Michelin tyres. And they seem to be good on one lap pace, but I'm yet to be convinced on full stint lengths.
Yeah, because this is the first Le Mans in a long time where we've had a proper tyre battle in LMP2. I think last year there was no LMP2 cars with Michelins.
They were all Dunlops, I think, yeah.
Because Dunlop has been the dominant tyre for LMP2 for a long time. But I will say, should it rain at Le Mans, and we all know it always rains at Le Mans, the Michelin cars will skyrocket to the top of the field because the Michelin rain tyre is just monstrously better than the Dunlop rain tyre. I don't even think the Dunlop rain tyre is worth putting on. I think in the past, whenever it's been raining, the Dunlop's runners have all put intermediates on.
Well, the Dunlop, I think Dunlop have claimed that they have improved their wet weather tyre performance, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, we will have to wait and see. Moving on then to the next of the Ligiers, number 25, Algarve Pro Racing. This is a Ligier coming from the European Le Mans Series, featuring Mark Patterson, Ante Zhong, and Taksung Kim. No drivers that I recognize. I recognize the car as being a mid to low pack running car in the ELMS. And do we really expect much happening from this car? I mean, it's got three bronze drivers as well.
No,
no.
If good on them to finish. I hope this car finishes where I'm in that category.
I would agree with you definitely.
And Flexbox.
Let's move on then to probably one of the favorites for this class. This is the number 26 G Drive Racing car run by with drivers gold rated Roman Rusinov, platinum rated John Eric Verne, and the silver in this car is Andrea Pizzatola. So this car has been a former champion in the WEC. Maybe not. Have they won at Le Mans before? I feel like they've come very close second before, the year that Alpine won, so 2016. This car has actually dropped to the ELMS for this season, not running in the super season, but did take victory at Spa as a non-full season entry. And has been the class of the field in the ELMS so far. So, do we expect any other team to be able to beat the 26 car?
Yeah, I think we all have other teams that are going to be up with the 26. Although I would definitely say the 26 is the favorite. They for sure were able to pretty much run the class at Spa. Their previous experience in the WC and the, you know, issues that they had previously last year, notwithstanding, they have experience at Le Mans. This is a solid team, and they know what it takes to win here. And yeah, these guys should be a favorite for at least the podium, if not higher.
There is also a little bit of a interesting driver going-ons in this team. So the reserve driver for this car is Alexander Imperatore. It's a gold-rated driver. The interesting thing about this entire situation is that should they need to activate the reserve driver, it doesn't matter which of the three drivers that the gold driver will replace. It doesn't matter, even if it is Andrea Pizzatola, the silver rated driver. That means, in theory, should Pizzatola somehow be unable to race, this car could run with an all-pro lineup. Now, there has been a little bit of contention about that, because that was actually what could have happened at the very beginning of the season. This is the same, I can't remember the word I'm looking for. Basically, it's the same sort of deal with having Heinrich Hedman as a bronze driver in P1. The same sort of dispensation, there you go. They can actually have the Alexander Imperatore, a gold-rated gold-rated driver, fill in for an AM at Le Mans. What do we think of that?
Yeah, they found a loophole, right? This is a loophole, right?
Yeah, so the cynic in me is questioning how likely it is that Pizzatola gets gets sick on race day and has to be activated for Imperatore. How likely do you reckon that is?
Pretty likely.
Maybe. I hope there's more integrity with G-Drive, but we'll see.
Either way, that car is still going to be extremely strong. I feel like they were in the top three on the test day. They were, in fact, third with a lap by John Eric Verne, just outside a second away from the top lap in that class. And so we should see them being a definite favorite. Although I said that last year, and Rusinov put it in the wall within an hour of running. So who knows? Really, who knows? So moving on now to the next car on the entry list, we're going to move to the number 28, Orica 07 of TDS Racing, featuring the bronze François Perrotto, Matteo Vaxivière as a gold driver, and Loic Duval as the platinum driver in that car. Now, this car, for me, is one of the top contenders for the LMP2 class at Le Mans this year. Would you guys agree?
Yep.
That was easy. What about you, Cookie?
Yes, because I don't like... I'm kidding. This is definitely one of my picks for potential podium.
So they've proven it in ELMS. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. So firstly, this car features François Perrotto and Matteo Vaxivière, who raced here together last year. Now, their co-driver at the time last year was Emmanuel Collard. Now, he's been moved on from the team in favor of Loic Duval, of course, former Audi LMP1 driver. And as Trevor Vasora said, this car in the ELMS has been tearing it up. It has come home with 2 second place finishes so far, and a decent result at the Spa 6 hours as well. So, as far as the closest challenger to the 26 G Drive car that we just had previously, I reckon this has to be the car that they're most looking over their shoulder for.
See, I don't share 100% your confidence, but I do think if Perrotto puts in solid stints. And Duval just is a former Audi F1 driver, or P1 driver, I should say, and is consistent that way. Vaxivière is just, I'm over the moon with him in terms of his performance so far, especially even this year. I mean, he's looked fantastic. So if he puts up another solid performance, this should be well up the P2 charts.
Now, I'm a bit cautious of singing Vaxivière's praises because they did that last year and he basically killed the Ricci team. But...
He did
release a very, very mature statement after that, and he did go to the team and apologize profusely. And from that, he has actually gotten a lot more aware of his driving and traffic. And I think that will bode him well for this season and this year's Le Mans. And he's also fast as all hell. So I'm putting this as a smoky for the podium.
Yeah, I'm trying to move past the Rizzi accident last year, so that's why I didn't.
I think everyone's trying to move past the Rizzi.
That was horrible, so.
Yeah. Now to one of the favorites of the field, at least amongst some of us in this chat room at the moment, the Racing Team Netherlands Dallara of Fritz van Aert, Guido van der Garde, and Leanne Lammers. So, Trevor Vasoris, why do we all love this car?
Oh, it's just a bit of fun, really. I really... enjoyed when I was in Le Mans last year for the first time, and it was also their first year. It was just a great experience. You know, the old guys, they're not going to win. They're just there for the pure passion and enjoyment of the race. Yeah, I just find it fun.
And the fact that they actually have 3 Dutch drivers running now, as opposed to the 2 Dutch and a Brazilian last year, is another big plus for the team, because of course Racing Team Netherlands, you need Dutch people behind the wheel. So they've subbed out from last year Rubens Barrichello with another former F1 driver, Guido van der Garde, who was amazing at Spa-Francorchamps until the car encountered a few problems. So this is definitely going to be a fun car, especially when Guido's behind the wheel, because you'll just see him fly.
Were they, weren't they leading the class?
They were.
By 18 seconds.
So, okay, like, yes, everyone remembers that they were leading by quite a fair way, but that was a little artificial considering that Guido van der Garde was in the car alongside a number of AMs at the time. So, while he was quick and the Michelin seemed to be on fire at that point in time, you have to remember that he was racing a bunch of silver and bronze drivers.
Noted. Yep.
So do we expect this car to place?
Place in finishing order, yes. Not anywhere where I'd expect any considerable mention.
Yeah.
I agree.
Because I feel like Jan Lammers and Fritz van Aert, while legends and, you know, fantastic drivers in their own right, aren't at the standard that they need to be to carry this car up to a competitive finish.
I agree. It's a talking point for Jan. His 24th Le Mans,
yeah.
Yeah, overall, it's a nice potential final race before Nyck de Vries comes in another young up-and-coming racer, which will raise the performance of the team after Le Mans. It's just nice.
I reckon De Vries is going to be a very good driver for that car, and so we'll keep an eye on that in the future, but at least for this year's Le Mans, maybe not someone to keep an eye on for the LMP2 class honours. Now, someone who could possibly take the LMP2 class honours, the Dragon Speed 31 car, the LMP2 car, featuring the silver of Roberto Gonzalez, who previously raced with RGR Sport. Yeah, there we are. So previously with RGR Sport, also in that car is Nathaniel Berthon, a longtime LMP2 driver, and another former F1 driver, Pastor Maldonado.
Yep, super quick, but we'll see if he can get through all of his stints unscathed.
You do say super quick, and this car was the fastest at the test day, putting in the LMP2 time of 3:27.2 to be the fastest car at the test day, and they were extremely fast as well at Spa. So as far as pure pace, they have been on it every single step of the way. It will be a matter, as you said, of trying to keep that car out of other cars. But to be honest, they did a very good job of that at Spa.
Yeah, but they do very well on the Michelins on single lap pace. I'm still undecided on race pace on the Michelin tire. So if it's good conditions for the Michelin tire, then this is a top shout for the class win.
And Lada's just flooded the chat room with images of Maldonado doing Maldonado things. Which I actually don't think is a fair representation of his driving in a P2 car thus far.
He did have an issue with a P1 car, if I remember correctly, at Spa later in the race, in terms of potentially the P1 had to make avoiding moves to kind of get out of this because he just didn't spot him. So I do think his pace is there. His awareness overall is not as crisp as I would say a top flight P1 or F1 driver is, in my opinion. So he's still a potential. Okay. He's like a Juan Montoya ask for me.
I'd pay that. So I agree with Troy Vasaurus in saying that if the pace is on for the Michelins, we could see this car on the top three. What about you, Cookie?
Yeah, I would agree with Trev in terms of his questioning of the pace of Michelins on long stints. We've yet to see it. The pace is certainly there, even with a P2 field. That's a pretty quick time too. So if I can just surmise anything from test day, this car should have pace. It's whether or not the drivers again will be able to keep up with it. I don't actually think this thing will place on the podium. So,
oh, okay. That's very bold.
Yep.
Fair enough.
I'm not high on this one.
We'll move on then. We've already talked about United Autosport, so we'll move on to the Jackie Chan DC Racing effort. So Jackie Chan GC Racing are bringing along four cars for a fleet that rivals that of Ford and Porsche, because they don't not only have the two cars, the two Orecas from the WEC effort, they also won two entries to Le Mans through the Asian Le Mans series, which are being run by Oak. So they will feature two Orecas and two Ligiers at this year's Le Mans. Now, Jackie Chan DC Racing was the breakout story of last year's Le Mans, of course, taking home two overall podiums from the P2 class. So it was ridiculous scenes, and had the Porsche spent another 10 minutes in the pits, they would have taken the overall win, let's not forget. So they have already big shoes to fill based on last year's results. And they have a very varied and interesting driver lineup across the four cars. So the two Asian Le Mans Series cars feature a all-silver lineup of David Chang, Nicolas Boulet, and Pierre Nicolet in the 33 car, and then Ricky Taylor, Combe Lettergar, and David Hennemeyer Hansen in the 34 car. Now, of those two, the 34 car looks scary quick to me.
The driver lineup is fantastic, and as much as I was low on the Dragon Speed entry, I really like this one, even though I don't think the pace is there fully with the Ligier chassis. I love the 34 driver lineup. I think that's a great endurance lineup.
Yeah, And, like, I will, for those who don't know Combe Lettinger, who, that might be an odd name to some people. Combe Lettinger has been a factory McLaren GT driver, with Garage 59 and Straka when Straka was running the team for the past few years, and has won the Blancpain Endurance Championship alongside Rob Bell and Shane Van Gisbergen. So he's a quality driver. Ricky Taylor, we all know, of course, from the IMSA competition, who is running in, I keep forgetting, is it Ricky who's still running the Cadillac, or has he moved on to the Acura?
Penske.
He's in Penske. And David Hennemeyer Hansen is possibly the best true AM driver in this class currently.
Oh, but yeah. Yeah. The only one potentially would be Rusinov, but
he's a gold now.
Last year. Yeah. Yeah. But I would even rate David Hennemeyer Hansen potentially better than Rusinov in certain aspects.
Wow. Okay.
So,
That's a pretty bold call.
Man, you were calling me out with bold calls here. I don't think that's hard to imagine. Rusinov has an experience streak of crashing into things and being stupid.
Okay, yes, that's true. But David Hennemeyer Hansen, the thing with David Hennemeyer Hansen is that every single time he does something amazing, which is surprisingly often, it's still surprising. So I don't know why I think David Hennemeyer Hansen is still, I don't know why it's still surprising to me, but I think he's great, but I don't know that I put him on the same level as Rusinov, but yeah, as you said, okay. Rusinov does have a bit of a fiery temper, let's put it that way.
He raced in ALMS too, so I've had a lot of experience watching him move up the ranks for P2. You can see the progression he's made in for experience.
Okay, yeah, that's fair enough then. Now the other two cars, for Jackie Chan DC are the two WEC full season entries, the Orica's. The number 37 car features an all Malaysian lineup, of Jasmine Jafar, Nabil Jeffrey and Vairon Tan, or Vairon Tan. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that. Now the big headline for me there is Jasmine Jafar, who has come up through the HTP Motorsport ranks, in Blancpain as well. So that's a real big tick for me, in terms of that driver lineup. And then the second car, the number 38 from the WEC, has Hoping Tung, Stefan Rikomi, and Gabriel Albury. So what do we think of those two cars? Terrible source?
The Mighty 38, as people called it last year, I think. They've proven it themselves last year that they can keep a car out of trouble and not lose time in pit stops. So yes, the driving crew has changed a bit, but
a bit is a bit of an understatement, because out is, from that car is Thomas Laurent and Oliver Jarvis, which are two of the best LMP2 drivers from last year. And in is now Stefan Rikelmi and Gabriel Albury. I mean, Stefan Rikelmi, it's okay. And Gabriel Albury is someone who I've literally never encountered before. So I'm not exactly, you know, buzzing with excitement about those two drivers. And it kind of shows based on their, you know, results from the test. You know, these two cars were, you know, 10th and 11th. But to be fair, the two Ligier cars were 18th and 19th. So, you know, what were we saying about the Ligier before? The number 34 car being one for the podium? Just based on a test day, that's right out the window.
Yeah, I don't think it's up, you know, any of the Ligiers are due for a podium. I love the driver lineup, but yeah, I don't think the Ligiers have pace right now compared to the Orecas.
Okay.
We'll see if the Dallaras can do anything, but I still think Orecas chassis could beat.
So are we expecting more from the 38 car than the 34 perhaps?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yes, absolutely.
Fair enough.
They've been there before too, so I think they absolutely know what it takes to win and to do very well here.
And in saying that as well, the Jackie Chan DC car, the number 38 car, did finish second at Spa behind the all-conquering Rusinov Verne Pizzatola G-Drive car. So it's not exactly out of the question for them to be strong. And I've just been sent some very very interesting notes from Lada and Chris about Gabriel Albury. He's a GP3 rider, and he's only 20 years old, so of course he hasn't had much of a career as of yet. So still exciting times. Exciting times for if you're a Jackie Chan DC fan, because you'll have four cars to follow, because crap, man, that's ridiculous. How did they let four cars happen?
Regulations that permit champions of other series to come in. So, and if you have enough money to have the three sets of teams that can compete in the three feeder series to Le Mans, you could potentially have three teams that all go at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's a there. We're not going to get to the NASCAR rules where you can only bar teams from having a certain amount of like inner teams within the entire global effort. So I don't know.
And I think it's more lenient this time because it's Oak Racing rather than Jackie Chan DC Racing personnel, you could say.
Yeah.
I think that's
it's going to be interesting too. I mean, they have Oak Racing fielding one half of the outfit, and then you have Joda fielding the other half.
And we all know how much of a rivalry they have between the two of them. So
yeah, I mean, that's just crazy that they are able to get both of their outfits that are just storied franchises in at the same time to compete against each other. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. And the fact that they are running under the same team banner is also a very cool. Very cool thing to have happen, and we could see a bit of inter-team rivalry in a big way in those four cars. Moving on now to the number 35 SMP Racing car. This is the Dallara, run out of the SMP Racing garage, of course. Driving that car will be Victor Scheiter, Norman Nato, and a name that some people may recognize, Harrison Newey. Yes, that is the son of Adrian Newey, the car designer. So that's a pretty exciting prospect. And he has raced in the ELMS with, I think it's the Algarve Pro team that he races with in ELMS. And whenever he's been in the car, it's been exciting. Let's put it that way.
I look forward to more excitement in this race, especially with him and behind the wheel. It's good to have some younger talent, and especially if there's some pretty interesting background to it too. So bringing some attention there. Victor Scheiter, I think he's solid in terms of his previous experience as well. So I think this is going to be a midfield runner, and I hope to see them at the end. So I don't think they're going to be doing too much in the class, but we'll see.
So you say that, but Victor Scheiter, we all know, is a fantastic amateur driver. He's won the GTM World Championship in WEC before. And Norman Nato, I have been outstanded by his performances in the ELMS this season so far. It's been ridiculous seeing his car, which is the race engineering car in the ELMS, just fly up the field whenever he's behind the wheel.
Yeah, right. They got a debut win.
Yeah, and that was at Paul Ricard, which blew me away because I'd never even heard of the team before. And then to see them win the race, I was like, huh, okay then. I think this one could be definitely a dark horse. Maybe for a podium, maybe not for overall in LMP2, but definitely someone to keep an eye on at least.
I think this is going to be the best Dallara overall. But yeah, we'll wait and see.
Definitely. I actually agree with you very wholeheartedly on that one. We'll come to say why a bit later on. The next car, the number 36 car, is another one that I'm going to call as a podium contender for the LMP2 class. It's the Alpine Signatec car, driven by Nicolas Lapierre, André Nagauer, and Pierre Thirier. So Pierre Thirier, I would class in the best of the true AMs category, alongside David Hannemeyer Hansen. He had an awful season last year driving for Mr. Roman Rusinov in the G-Drive car. But they did take an extremely dominant win at Spa-Francorchamps, and Pierre Thirier it's still definitely got the quality behind him. And we know that the AM drivers in LMP2 are generally the most important piece of the puzzle in order to be a good car. And so I'm putting that one solely on the basis of Pierre Thirier in the fight for the podium, at least.
I agree, yeah. Yeah, it's a very strong lineup.
Because not only do you have Pierre Thirier, but you also got former Toyota LMP1 driver Nicolas Lapierre, who we've all seen pull some crazy stuff and get away with it. The race-winning pass at Spa-Francorchamps in 2016 comes to mind, for example. And André Nagel, who has been one of the most ridiculous pickups for the Alpine team over the past few seasons, who basically single-handedly won them the 2016 championship just by being the best AM driver that there was. To be fair, he was like a false AM coming from GP2, but still, it was silver-rated, and he basically just pulled away along with the pros.
I think this is a potential top five car. I'm just so done with Alpine, so I just wish it would just go to Oreca and not be whatever this is in DPI format.
Yeah,
whatever they're racing. Yeah, I think this is going to be a great car. I'm just fatigued with the whole whatever this is kind of thing. So they'll do well.
Oh, but I love the blue Alpine car. I mean, yeah, it's basically a Renault factory crew, but still,
Then make a P1 car and call it a Renault. Let's see them here again.
I mean, if Renault want to call, okay, let's we'll do that then. Fine. After this, after this season, there will be a P1 car. Please don't hurt me.
Okay.
to be fair though, it is just an Alpine by name, right? It's just right. It's not actually a factory Alpine team. It is just named an Alpine for, you know, promotion purposes. It comes back to that classic Frenchie being Frenchie thing again.
I wish they like Team Netherlands would rename their car like the Jumbo P217 or something like that. I mean, it seems like that's what, like, they're just allowed to do that if they're OEM or something. I don't know. Whatever. But yes, okay. this car, top five. I love the driver lineup. I think it's solid. Nicolas Pierre is probably one of the best P2 drivers right now in this field. So can't go wrong with that.
I feel like if the car gets to the finish, it'll be on the podium.
Yes.
Trovosaurus?
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is, you know, super strong. Yeah. One of the best lineups.
Cool. So we'll move on then. We've already talked about the 37 and 38, so we'll move to the two Graf cars. So you might notice that one of them is labeled a G-Drive car. That car is actually being entirely run by Graf Motorsports, not by G-Drive. It is just running G-Drive sponsorship. So we have the 39 and the 40. So the 39 features Vincent Capillier, Jonathan Hershey, and Tristan Gomedy. And the number 40 has James Allen, Jose Gutierrez, and Enzo Guibert. However you say that. I'm doing well with pronunciation today, aren't I? Apparently that was well pronounced. So, okay, let's go with that.
Perfect.
So the 39 car, Vincent Capillier has the infamous reputation of being the guy that destroyed the Toyota from last year. So let's hope that he can shake that off with a good drive this year. Because of course he was the one dressed up in that red fire suit who gave the thumbs up to Kamui Kobayashi, who misinterpreted that as a sign to go from the pit lane, resulting in the burnt out clutch that ultimately destroyed the Toyota number 7 car last year. But the two other drivers in that car, Jonathan Hershey and Tristan Gomedy, especially, jumping over from Jackie Chan GC, has been an awesome driver in LMP2 for a long time. So, I'm expecting good things from the number 39 car. Number 40 car, maybe less so, but I do have some patriotic connection with that car. James Allen, of course, being Australian. Gotta support my Australian bros. So, yeah, Aussie, right? So we'll see. We'll see how that car goes. But of these two cars, I'm expecting the 39 to be the stronger of the two.
Correct. Yeah, these are great. These are class run outfits, and I think they'll be top 10. I don't think they'll be. I don't think they'll be close-ish to the podium. They'll be close to the podium, but I don't think they'll hit it yet. But I do agree with you there. The 39 lineups better.
Yep, and the 39 was the better placed car on the test day, finishing off 7th with a 29.4. The G-Drive car, G-Drive wrapped car, was just outside that with a 9th placed 330.015. They're too closely matched, but I would still put the 39 ahead. Anything you want to add to that one, Trevorosaurus?
I think these are relying on, I'm not trying to be harsh, but these entrants might be up there, but relying on certain problems from their competitors.
And I mean, you will get, you know, not everyone can run up the top of the field, so you know, a good midfield battle will add a lot of context to the race, I think. If either of these two were to break into the top battle, I do think it would be the 39. Cookie, I feel like you deserve the honours of introducing the next car to us.
Oh, it's the number 44 Eurasia Motorsport Ligier, driven by Andre Bertolini, Nick Johnson, and my homie, my boy, my compatriot, Tracy Krohn, in the Krohn Aviation lime green blue Crash-O-Matic P2 car.
Oh, it just keeps getting better. Of course. This is actually, I think, Tracy Krohn and Nick Johnson's 7th or 8th Le Mans together. So, hey, they're keeping the streak alive, so...
Okay, this is, I think, the fastest car Tracy Crone's ever driven, too. I don't think he drove last year in P2. So, will the car get any air, is my question, when he crashed.
No, he drove in P2 in 2016. Right, but I remember he crashed into John Pugh.
And then what was it, the year before he crashed out in FP1, and then hit, that was like after the Dunlop Bridge, he like got air. I think that was a P2 car. But no, he didn't race last year, and this is the new iteration of the P2 cars, which are faster than the old ones. So there's more power for this dude to get some more velocity towards whatever object he hurls himself towards. So
we're so confident in him. See, the thing is with Tracy Crone, right, is that he's extremely fast for an amateur driver. He's probably one of the fastest silver drivers of his age, but he just keeps making mistakes. The at least last year he was spinning on his own and not involving anyone else. I hope that is the case again this year, because you don't want him crashing into other people. If he spins by himself, it's fine. We all have a laugh and we go on with our day. But if he takes out another driver, it won't be good. But if he keeps it on track, that car all of a sudden becomes a great contender.
Yeah, besides him, the lineup is great. I have no problems at all with it, the rest of it.
Because is Andrea Bertolini another one of our former F1 stars, or is he just a crazy, ridiculously fast Italian that hasn't raced an F1 yet?
I think he's a test driver, or was a former test driver. Don't quote me on that, though.
Yeah, so...
But he's still got talent.
Yeah, the car's still definitely got pace. It's just a matter of, can Tracy Crone keep it on track?
Yeah, it's a Ligier chassis, so if they finish plus one, but Trace will spin at least two or three times. Hopefully he just doesn't hit anything.
Yeah, fingers crossed, right? Fingers crossed. Yeah. So shall we move on then?
Yes, please. Get away from this.
To the last of the Dallaras in this class, the number 47 Settila Villorba Corsica. This is a team stepping up from the ELMS, featuring Robert Lacourte, Giorgio Cernagiotto, and Felipe Nasr. So... two Italians and a Brazilian. Felipe Nasr has been fantastic in the IMSA WeatherTech series at the seat of the number 31 wheel and engineering car, to the point where he basically single-handedly won the Long Beach race. So when he's in the car, that car is going to be stupidly fast. The fact of the matter is, the other two drivers may be not the same level.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
So you said that the SMP racing car was going to be the best of the Dallaras. Why would this car not be in the same sort of conversation?
Good point. Good point.
I like this lineup too. The Nasr. The Nasr obviously stands out, but
yeah, it comes down to the bronze drivers in this, or the amateur drivers rather, because there's no bronze in the SMP.
Yeah, that's a pretty fair assessment. In saying that, though, this car didn't... Whereabouts is it on the test day? Oh, wait,
Keep going down.
It was eighth, so it was actually faster than the S&P racing car. But again, that was probably mostly NASA's doing. And it was the best of the... Dallaras last year, although in saying that, the only other Dallara that really had a chance, well, S&P Racing was there last year as well, so it could be better than the S&P Racing car, but I like this car a lot because it is a dark, deep blue car with the Dallara chassis with the 47 that reminds me of the old KCMG car that won in 2015, and so that it holds a special place for me because that KCMG car was the best thing to ever happen to LMP2 at Le Mans. So do we expect this to break out of the midfield at all?
I think at points, but I think this is a midfield. This has midfield written all over it.
Travis,
yeah, I agree.
Okay, yeah. So
it's a midfield runner.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. We'll be exciting when Nasr gets in the car because he was just going to be amazing in terms of his relative pace. But yeah, I don't think it'll push too far up the grid. One car I do think will push further up the grid is the 48 car, the IDEX Sport Orica, featuring Paul Lafarge, Paul Loup-Chatin, and Memo Rojas. Now, this car was the fastest or second fastest on the test day, at the hands of Memo Rojas, with a 3:27.252, a whole 24 thousandths of a second outside the top time. They've a team from the European Le Mans series, IDEX Sport, have been doing relatively well in ELMS. Nothing too extreme to write home about, but no glaring failures, I don't think. And with Paul Loup-Chatin and Memo Rojas, that's definitely a team to look out for. The question is, though, how competent will Paul Lafarge be against the other silvers?
Yeah, it's going to be a question of how their silver stacks up against the others. They have enough quality, I think, in the rest of their pro drivers that for their test day speeds, the car is the setup, at least within the team, is fantastic. So pace is there. It will definitely be down to how traffic works and basically how Paul manages throughout the race. So, but this is definitely it's higher than midfield for me. So this will be definitely competing top five, top ten in class, I think. We'll see.
I'm not so sure because of the tire situation as well.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why it was up there so close to the, or up there with the Dragon Speed car was the superior, to me, superior one lap pace or qualifying kind of pace of the Michelin tire. So, we'll wait and see, I guess. As with the Dragon Speed, is they're the only Michelin tired Oricas. So if, like we said earlier, Michelin are the tire to be on, then, they'll be right up there with the Dragon Speed.
Yeah. That's definitely a fair point and not something we really have considered too much, over the course of this. However, I do want to make the point that this will be a pretty big step up in terms of relative pace for Paul Lafarge, who last year raced along with, his father, is it Patrice Lafarge? And
that rings a bell, yeah.
And David Zollinger in the number 17 IDEX Sport car. So a very big difference in expectation. Because that was very much a amateur outfit going for a ride, whereas this is, you know, something that should be challenging for some top positions, especially with the likes of Memo Rojas behind the wheel, who last year was in their championship-winning ELMS car. So it does bring along that weight of expectation for this car. So that would be something to watch out for. Finally, we get to the end of the LMP2 class with the number 50 Labra competition car. This car is a Ligier, and it is actually one of the prettiest cars in the field, I think, with this white livery with blue secondary colors and this like crazy pink accents, which just look really, really cool. Driving the car will be Erwin Creed, Romano Ricci, and Thomas Dragano. As I feel like how you say that. Did I get that right? Who knows anymore? So do people hold any hope for this car?
No, not for me. a bit harsh, but no.
Why do we say that, everyone?
Well, they're bronze all drivers, so yeah.
That pretty much sums it up. This was the last car from the LMP2 field at Spa. This was the lowest placed car in the test day. I feel like they also had problems at the test day as well, which limited their running. And it's three French bronze drivers in a French car running in a French race. So it's the Frenchies being Frenchies thing again, which we just come to sort of accept, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. And there's always got to be the one car that finishes last in pace. So probably going to be Labra this year. The Ligier just hasn't, they haven't really been able to find any pace in that car anyway, so.
I feel like they should at least have a decent battle along with the number 25 Algarve Pro Racing car. I feel like the two of them are going to be similar on pace, and it'll be an interesting battle between the two of them.
Agreed.
Cool. So that brings us to the very end. Lastly, of course, in true endurance chat spirit, who is going to be your top three for the race? Go, Trevor Saurus.
top three, I can't put them in order.
Not good enough. No, okay, you can not put them in order. You don't have to put them in order.
I've got a short list that I've written down, but I can't get through like a set three.
Be brave. Be brave.
G Drive, it's got to be said.
Which one?
The G Drive. So the 26.
Yep.
The Signatec Alpine.
Yep.
And I'm gonna have to go with another Orica, number 38.
Number 38. Okay. Yep. That's all right. Cookie.
Almost identical. The 26 for me and the 38. So the G Drive and the JCDC, Orica's. And then, man, yeah, it's that third one. I kind of do want to lean a little towards, the United Autosport camp for.
Ooh, that's a brave call.
I know. Potentially 32. So,
really? You said that one was going to be the...
Probably the 22. If it's going to be United, I probably should just take the figure out. I don't want to... 22, because I'm going out of limb anyway. Honestly, if I could, I would just mirror Trez. I would probably
take
36.
You can if you want to.
I want to say 22. Okay. I want to say 22.
Okay, you can say 22.
Yeah.
I'm going to agree with both of you and say the 26 is going to be on the podium. But I'm going to put on the podium as well the number 36 Signatec Alpine and the number 28 TDS racing car. Yep. They've really taken a step up from their efforts last season, and I hope to see them on the podium. Other cars on my short list, for those interested, was the 38, the 34, and the 39. So I feel like that's going to be the core of the next group of cars. Maybe let's chuck into that the SMP racing car as well. But yeah, I think the 26 is just the outright favorite. So of course, watch it crash into a Porsche and the Porsche curves in the first hour of the race.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it has been written.
So it has been written. Well, you just know that's going to end badly for everyone involved. So yeah, there we go. There's the 30 prototype cars for the 24 Hours of Le Mans this year. If you agree with us, that's good. Let us know. If you don't agree with us, tell us why we're wrong in the comments. And yeah, thank you very much for coming along and going through that with us, Trovosaurus and Cookie Monster FL.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Flood.
No problems. And thank you all very much for listening. This will be a very interesting Le Mans. Hopefully, for Cookie's sake, Toyota gets the finish. Hopefully for the rest of us, our predictions are somewhat correct, so that way we don't get horribly embarrassed. And hopefully for everyone involved, we'll have a good race. Peace out, guys. Thank you very much.
Gazoo, Alonso. I do love the random, very, very small British, like, advertisers on the Jannettas. It makes it feel very homely.
I'm going to Le Mans with three people from Yorkshire. So,
oh, God.
I'm not going to hear the end of this.
Brilliant.
I just want them to spell Top Gear, like, really naughty words when you open doors or you, like, remove body panels. Like, that's all I really want at this point.
You should have seen the amount of Yorkshire tea they brought last year.